So we're going to turn to that dramatic passage that we read a few moments ago from Daniel, Daniel chapter 3. And like I said a moment ago, of course you have to remember the context that Nebuchadnezzar in the previous chapter has had this vision, and it's been revealed to him. He ends the chapter by acknowledging the fact there is a God in heaven. There is. It's true. There is a God in heaven, and that God, he acknowledges, is the God of gods. He's the absolute. Whatever idols or little gods we might have, he is the real God, the absolute, unchanging, eternal God. And he acknowledged that he's the Lord of kings. So that means that whatever king is around, that king is not the absolute king is God. Now, I don't know what prompted him to bring about chapter 3. Whether it was the idea that he rather liked himself as the head of gold. I mean, that's quite a nice image, isn't it? And maybe he was transfixed upon that. Or maybe it was as he considered this statue that he just thought about, the feet. Well, it fell over maybe because it had divided feet. Thought Nebuchadnezzar. Maybe I need to unify everything. And I don't like the idea of this absolute God. I'm the king. I'm the king, thought Nebuchadnezzar. And I need to unify the nation. I need to firm things up a bit. And so he did. He made not just a head of gold. He made a big, tall statue of gold, an image representing the culture of Babylon. And the worship of this image surely would get rid of that notion of divided kingdom. He would unify the kingdom. Every nation and language and all the exiled peoples, they can come together and unify over the worship of the image of Babylon. That's what he would do. The image was about 90 feet high. I looked up online what that might look like. Apparently, I don't know whether this helps, it's about the height of two brachiosauruses. Does that help? No, it doesn't really, does it? It is about three telegraph poles. Okay, so imagine three telegraph poles of wood, about that sort of height. So it's quite high. And in the plains of Jewry, gets everyone gathered. Three telegraph poles, covered, and they're kind of covered in gold. It's a statue. Maybe it's an image of himself. It wouldn't surprise me. And there it was. Now, this chapter really is about how God delivers his people. But along the way, we see the pressures of his people living in a secular world, a secular culture, a culture that is rebelling, rejecting God. And so as we read this, it's really relevant. Because are we not living in a culture that is wrestling with God, is pushing God out of the way? And the pressures that they faced, can I suggest that we face on a daily basis? But remember, it's about God's deliverance. So let's have a look firstly about three pressures that we receive, we feel, living in a secular culture. First of all, they felt the pressure to conform. The pressure to conform. Some people come to me and they say, Adam, I think you're a Christian just because you come from a Christian family. You've just conformed to your parents' faith. You've just adopted their patterns and their values. But you know, that argument can go both ways, can't it? Could it not be said that for the vast majority of people, they have just conformed to the culture in which they're born into? They've absorbed the values and the patterns and the goals that are impressed upon them by their culture. It was that way in Babylon, certainly. The invitation had arrived in the post. Shadrach probably opened it up in haste. It's from Neb. Oh, we're invite. Invite, love. It's, oh, we are requested to... Oh, hang on. Not requested, expected. We're expected to attend the revealing of an impressive new image that would represent the culture of Babylon. This will unite all people together in submission to serve and worship the image. Gosh, Shadrach looked at the image, at the piece of paper. There was no RSVP at the bottom. This was a command. Everyone in the empire was to come to the revealing of the statue in the plains of Dura. And as the weeks went past, the rhetoric was ramped up. This was no request. This was a demand. And anyone who did not come and bow and serve and worship would be thrown into a fiery furnace. That was the rhetoric coming out of Babylon. And the morning came of the ceremony. Can you imagine the pressure that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego felt that morning as they came down for breakfast? And they looked at the breakfast table, and their wives and their children were there. And they had to say, look, chaps, I may not be coming home this evening. I'm not going to bow to the image. And their children said, Daddy, please, you can't do that. Just bow with your knee, Daddy. It doesn't matter. It doesn't change what's in your heart. Oh, come on, darling. No. No, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego had thought and prayed about this. No, there is a true God, a real God, and we know him and we love him. And we know what his character is like and his commands, and we shall not serve another. We shall not serve another. And whatever excuses they might come up with, they knew the right and the wrong in their heart. And so they left their families that morning. They'd got dressed for the ceremony. They've got their hats on. You read in the passage, their hats and their turbans and all the festal clothes. They didn't want to just stand out. They weren't being weird. They weren't just trying to be difficult. But they had got a line, and they weren't going to cross that line. And they go down to the ceremony. Gosh, they were all there in their hundreds and thousands. And Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, well, they were higher up. They were overseeing the affairs of the province of Babylon. And so they were there with all their friends, the clever and educated people at the front. And they go on up, and their friends are beckoning them. Shadrach, this way. Come and stand with us for the ceremony. You can stand here, Shadrach. Meshach, come and stand with us. Thanks for inviting us for dinner last week. It was brilliant. You can come round to ours next week. Shadrach gulps. Will there be a next week? Meshach's next door neighbor is there. Oh, isn't this wonderful? Such a sense of community, Meshach, isn't it? Look at all the people unified together. And look at the orchestra. It's the full royal orchestra. Look, you can read it, can't you? I'm not going to repeat all the instruments that were there. But we had all the string section and the wind section. It was all there, the mood, the atmosphere. Oh, and the statue, dazzling in the sunlight, so big and powerful. What a great empire we belong to, Abednego. Isn't this wonderful? And then the music started. Oh, it was really quite emotional. A few people were probably crying. This is lovely. This is wonderful. This is what life is all about, some were saying. I love being part of this Babylon. And then as it got to the crescendo, the time came. And everyone fell on their knees. Everyone. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego looked round, and they were down in their hundreds and thousands on their faces before this golden image of Babylon. And Shadrach's friends were shouting at him, kneel down! Are you mad? Shadrach wasn't going to kneel down. Just tie your shoelaces. Abednego, there's some rubbish. Pick it up, quick! They were probably tugging at their cloaks. Just get down. We like you as friends, isn't it? Pull, come on. But Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego would not go down that morning. Because they principled in their heart. They principled that it was wrong to worship another. The pressure to conform was huge. The peer pressure, the emotional hype, the mood, the community, the rhetoric, the threat. Oh, the pressure was so great. Someone came to me this week and they said, Adam, I know in my heart that I've got to do something. It's the right thing to do. I know it's the right thing to do, they said. But it's going to be really hard. And it's going to cause trouble. But I know it's the right thing. Should I do it? We all go through questions like that, don't we? We know the right thing to do, but it's so hard. It's so hard sometimes, especially when no one else is doing it. Or we know sometimes there's something that everyone else is doing and it's wrong. And we know we shouldn't join in. We shouldn't just adopt that cultural idea, but it's so hard to not do it. It's so hard not to conform to our culture. It's easy to make excuses, tie your shoelaces, pick up the lid. But if they had have done, they could have easily bowed that morning, couldn't they? But had they done that, they knew in their hearts that it was wrong. And so they stuck up for what is right. You know, I came across a story of a man, I think he was the Bishop of Worcester, or certainly a clergyman in Worcester, in the First World War. And he left his wife and his young child to go to the trenches. And he wrote a letter to his wife and his young child back at home. And he says this is quite incredible stuff. He says to his wife, "The first prayer I want my son to learn to say for me is not, 'God, keep Daddy safe.' The first prayer I want my son to learn is, 'God, make Daddy brave. And if he has hard things to do, make him strong to do them. Life and death don't matter, my son. Right and wrong do. Daddy dead is Daddy still, but Daddy dishonored before God is something too awful for words." They're quite powerful words he wrote to his wife, aren't they? But he knows that the right thing to pray is make Daddy brave. And if he has to do the right thing, help him do it. And maybe as we project our mind into the coming week, we know maybe the pressures we're feeling to be or do something that we know we shouldn't be or do. And our prayer maybe this morning needs to be, "God, make me strong. Make me brave to do the right thing, to not conform to this culture, but rather be transformed by your word." So the pressure to conform was very great that morning. But secondly, they faced the pressure to worship and serve an idol. They did, didn't they? That's what it was. It was an idol. It looked pretty impressive. It was it was tall and it was gold. And there was a lot of pomp and ceremony around it, but it was just an idol. And the writer of Daniel chapter 3, I think he writes with a degree of comedy, a bit of satire as he writes it. He describes what it was like attending the ceremony. And he says, well, there were the satraps, the prefects, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates. Oh, it's such a long list, isn't it? And then we find in the next verse, instead of saying, "and they all bow down," he does the whole list again. He wants to stress the fact that all these people are here. The clever, the educated, the wise, the greats of Babylon. anyone who's anyone was standing there in their regalia. And then he tells us what they were all doing. In verse 3, he says, and there they were, and they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar has set up. It's a bit like the elephant in the room. We've just had, at the end of chapter 2, the revelation that there's a God in heaven. And he's the God of gods and the Lord of kings. And his kingdom lasts forever. And then we look at this image. All the clevers and the greats and the people, anyone who's anyone, and they just stood like lemons before what might as well be 3 telegraph poles. I mean, how ridiculous. For all the pomp and the power, pomp and ceremony, there is no power. That image can't do anything. What a ridiculous, ridiculous sight. But that is idolatry, isn't it? That is idolatry. It's serving a nothing. And you say, well, I'll never be tempted to serve a nothing. But we are. What are the images of our culture? Well, we go to London and we maybe look at Westminster. And we have it on our TV screens, don't we? The laws that are made in this country. It is pretty great being British. And we go to Canary Wharf, as I'm sure Dave Oldham looks at the walkie-talkie each day and the roof garden. And maybe we look at the gherkin and the images of economic power. We can power through Brexit, can't we? We're okay. Or maybe we turn on our TV and we have the messages coming out. What we need to satisfy our cravings. Maybe we open the letterbox and receive the junk mail and we have a picture of a very happy family. What do we need? Oh, we need a smart meter, love. That will solve all of our problems. It'll make us happy. But we do, don't we? And we all have these idols that we set up. And we think they're gonna meet all of our needs. Whether it's a thing like a car or a person or a family, or whether it's deeper. Maybe it's something that we hope those things will meet. Maybe it's our yearning for security or comfort or happiness. And we desperately are running around trying to meet these needs when all along there's a God in heaven who gives himself to us to satisfy us completely. It's the same today. If we only, like Nebuchadnezzar will do in the next chapter, lift our eyes above the restlessness of this world and look at the God of heaven and capture a vision of his greatness and his love. And he gives us to himself and we're designed to worship him. And until we worship and serve him and enjoy him, all of our restlessness will never, ever be fulfilled, never be satisfied. We instead burden ourselves with worries and anxieties and woes that we needn't have. The New Testament is quite clear. It uses strong words about idols. It says, flee from them. It's quite an urgent word, isn't it? Flee. But we need to. It says, go out from their midst. It says, guard yourselves, keep yourselves from idols. Because the New Testament writers knew how destructive idols can be when they control us and we serve them and they take over and they burden us. Oh, what joy we miss out on when we push the living God out of the way and exchange him for a lie. So the pressure to conform, the pressure to worship and serve an idol. Thirdly, they were pressurized. They had a test of their loyalty. A test of their loyalty. Who were they really loyal to? You see, it had seemed like it was a success, first of all. Verse 7, Nebuchadnezzar looks out and everyone is down on the ground and it's rather wonderful. And he thinks this is really all that it was meant to be. But when we come to the next verse, we find that it hadn't actually been a success after all, because there were, in fact, three men who hadn't bended the knee. And so the Chaldeans come to Nebuchadnezzar, and they were obviously a bit annoyed that these three men were overseers and they'd got good jobs in the empire. And they come to Nebuchadnezzar and say, Nebuchadnezzar, there's three men and we've got three charges against them. They don't care about you, they say. They pay no attention to you. They do not serve your gods, and they don't worship the image that you have set up. Nebuchadnezzar, O king, live forever and ever, because you're great. And Nebuchadnezzar is filled with fury, and he summons the three men. And I don't know whether you've ever seen the images of what it would have been like in Babylon, but there was this big half a mile walk up to the palace. And as you walked up this walkway, up to the Ishtar Gate, there were these images of great lions all the way up, okay, about half a mile walk. Can you imagine Shadrach and Meshach up this walk? And the images of the power of Babylon all around them, up the steps through the great big Ishtar Gate. And then they're brought before the greatest man on earth, the king of Babylon. And he's not happy. He's furious with them. And he repeats the charges against them. But notice, when he repeats the charges against them, he doesn't repeat the first charge, that they pay no attention to him, because actually he knows they do. Because he knows Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego. He's given them really good jobs in the empire. He's promoted them. And I think this has made it all the worse. Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego, after I've been so good to you, I've raised you up above the other Chaldeans who were born into my culture. I've given you really good jobs. And despite how good and kind I've been to you, you will not bow down and serve my images. You could just pretend, but you won't. Let's try it again. I'm feeling in a furiously kind mood. Get the orchestra. Play the music. You will bow down. And Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are rather clear, aren't they? They say, okay, we have no need to answer you in this matter. Please, we don't need to think about our answer. Please, you don't need to gather the orchestra. It's not needed. Because we will not bow down to your image, O king. We won't. It's just not going to happen. We serve the living God who can save us. He may save us today, but if he doesn't, O king, may it be known to you that we won't worship your images. Our loyalty lies with the living God. They have an unswerving loyalty to God that no matter what happens, whatever happens, they will be loyal to him. They have that loyal faith that Job had. Do you remember when Job lost everything? And he says, though he slay me, yet I will trust in him. That's what these three men were saying. Whatever happens today, I will trust in my God. Because I know that I'm part of a kingdom that will last forever. This world is not all there is. And you can do your worst, king, but there is a God in heaven, and he is the king of the God of gods and the Lord of lords, and his kingdom does last forever. It reminded me, there's so many illustrations down history of men and women who have stood like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and they were unswervingly loyal to their God. There was a bishop in the Roman Empire called Polycarp, Bishop Polycarp, Bishop of Smyrna. And he was really old. He was 86, not old, sorry. He wasn't old. But he was getting on in his years. And he was a follower of Jesus. He loved Jesus. And at the age of 86, in an undignified fashion, the Roman authorities dragged him into the arena, into the stadium. And the crowds were there. And they said to Polycarp, come on. They actually said he was an old man, okay? They did. They said, be kind of dignified in your old age, they said to him. Be dignified. Just curse your Jesus and swear your allegiance to Caesar. Come on. And Polycarp's answer was so clear. Let me read you very briefly what he says. He says, I love what he says. He says, 86 years have I served him. He's talking about Jesus. 86 years have I served him, and he has done me no wrong. How then can I blaspheme my king who saved me? You can do your worst. They threaten the beasts, and he says, that's fine. And then that really annoys them, and then they said, okay, we'll burn you. And then he says, that's fine as well. Because your fire can only burn for an hour. But there's eternity ahead of us. And I'm part of an eternity that will never end. I'm part of God's kingdom. He showed unswerving loyalty to his God. Now, in verses 19 to 23 of Daniel chapter 3, wow, it really gets hot, okay? We see the power of Babylon. They did their worst. We find the king kind of contorting his face. It says in verse 19, Nebuchadnezzar was filled with fury, and the expression of his face changed. I don't know what it looked like. Somehow, he was really angry. He couldn't believe what he was hearing from these men. The mightiest man on earth raging at them. The heat of the fire was heated as hot as it could possibly go. It was overheated 7 times, as hot as it can go. He got the mightiest men he could find to come and take them and tie them and throw them. You say, gosh, this is a helpless situation as Babylon does its worst. But this story is about God's deliverance. And as we finish, That is the trajectory of travel in this passage. That we see that the God of gods and the Lord of kings and the revealer of mysteries is the God who saves his people. You see, it was without question that day that God brought about his deliverance. Nebuchadnezzar had a really tiring day. 7 times in this passage it talks about him setting up his image. A lot of setting up that morning. Setting up. And then he's furious rage leaping around. And then he's all that contorting. And he just sits down to watch them burn in the fire when he's up on his feet again. He's on verse 24. He's up on his feet. And this time in astonishment as he gazes into the fire. There's four in the fire. We bound them. But they're free. And they're walking around in the fire. And he comes and he calls them out of the fire. I expect his voice did change a little bit. It wasn't so rageful now. As he realizes that his power is no match for the God of gods and the Lord of kings. Come on out, Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego. And they didn't crawl out that day. They didn't kind of limp out from the fire. They walked out free, healthy, unharmed. And they weren't disfigured and marred from the flames. They were normal, healthy. In fact, they were better than when they went in because the cords had been broken. And they stood before them and they didn't even smell of smoke. You see, the image here is of a complete deliverance, utter deliverance, because it is God's deliverance. And the theme of the Bible, we must just dwell on this as we finish. The theme of the Bible is that this God in heaven is a God who completely delivers. Remember the Red Sea? He dramatically delivers his people from the Egyptians and smashes them all. Complete deliverance. And now we turn to the powers of Babylon. Complete deliverance. You see, 600 years later, God was going to bring his plan of deliverance to its crescendo as he sends his son to this world. Four men in the fire, you say? Four men? And the fourth looks like a son of the gods. Who was that there with Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego? Was it an angel? It could have been an angel. Or did they get a glimpse of the Lord Jesus Christ? God with them in the fire. 600 years later, we would find God with us on this earth. And he came to go to the fire for us. He didn't conform to his culture. He didn't worship other idols or even Satan when he was tempted. And regarding loyalty, he set his face like a flint towards Jerusalem. He would not be distracted or pulled because he knew that he'd come to completely deliver his people from their sin, from death, from Satan and all of his powers. We find him in a garden in Gethsemane, sweating drops of blood in anguish because he knows that that night ahead of him, he's going to take on himself the sin of the world. He's going to be sin for us. He's going to suffer the fire of the wrath of God so that we don't need to go to the fire. He's going to go through it for us. And this morning, maybe you are wrestling with idols. Maybe you are overtaken with fears of the future. Maybe you are eaten up with bitterness and anger. Maybe you are suffering with shame and guilt over things that have happened in the past. And God says, you don't need to be like that. Bring yourselves to the cross. Come to the place of deliverance where the God of heaven delivers his people and sets their bonds free. And as God's children this morning, we need to consider ourselves, don't we? Have we been conforming to our culture? What are the idols that consume us? Let us bring them this morning to the foot of the cross and consider, raise our eyes to heaven and see the greatness of our God and consider how great a deliverance he has made for us.